2015. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et de n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence. Keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Big question I get asked. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Saville for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Saville seems surprising.
It's remarkable that they didn't call upon the services of a professional PR company and they sought the services of Jimmy Savile. It just goes to show the lack of judgment and the lack of understanding of the potential for this kind of blowback when they cavort with these celebrities, not knowing anything about their background or not even trying to look into their background before they do so. We are talking about the royal family after all, aren't we?
These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without at a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps. The association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the Gulf of Mexico, still recovering from an estimated 134 million gallons of oil spilled by BP in 2010, the Biden administration has leased record-breaking offshore drilling rights to 33 gas and oil companies, including ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Chevron. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Ripton, political writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden issues more gas and oil drilling permits than Trump in his first year. Here's the story. Biden came to the presidency promising swift action on climate change. A year in office, it is critical to see what he has accomplished beyond rejoining the Paris Agreement. Despite campaign promises to halt gas and oil drilling on public lands, Biden has issued more drilling permits on federal lands than Donald Trump did in his first year. In the Gulf of Mexico, still recovering from an estimated 134 million gallons of oil spilled by BP in 2010, the Biden administration has leased record-breaking offshore drilling rights to 33 gas and oil companies, including ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Chevron. The 308 leased tracts in the Mexico Gulf cover 1.7 million of more than 80 million acres that the administration opened to auction in November 2021, the largest lease sale in the history of the country. While it is true that the Biden issued a moratorium on gas and oil drilling on public lands in his first month in office, it was blocked in the federal court. Attorneys general from 13 Republican states led by Louisiana successfully challenged the moratorium, effectively blocking it. U.S. District Judge Terry Doughty, a Trump appointee, ruled that the states would suffer job losses and other injury if the moratorium remained in force. He ordered the Biden administration to go forward with lease sales. Though the Interior Department appealed Doughty's decision, it nevertheless held the lease sales in November. Environmentalists condemned the auction of the offshore drilling rights in the Gulf of Mexico. Representing environmental interests, Earth Justice attorney Bretty Hardy warned that the auction of the Gulf of Mexico lease sales is basically a giveaway to industry of millions of acres of the Gulf of Mexico so they can lock in production for years, at a time when we need to be shifting away from fossil fuel development. Other critics, including some Democrats, said that the administration should have reviewed how the sale would affect climate change and held off the sale while the ruling was under appeal. The November sale of leases in the Gulf of Mexico came on the heels of the Glasgow COP26 negotiations to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. In Glasgow, President Biden acknowledged the gravity of climate change and the international community's need to act quickly. "This is a decisive decade in which we have an opportunity to prove ourselves. If we commit to doing our part of each of our nations with determination and with the ambition, that's what COP26 is all about." Yet the Gulf of Mexico leases make it difficult, if not impossible, to reach the administration's stated goal of limiting U.S. greenhouse gas emissions to 50 to 52% of the 2005 levels by 2030. Drilling gas and oil in the Gulf of Mexico makes up 20% of the carbon released on leased federal lands and waters. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that the U.S. discharged 6,558 metric tons of carbon in 2019, roughly 15% of the total world CO2 emissions. Even the economics of climate change calls for swift action. According to energy researchers at Princeton University, it will cost between $7.8 trillion and $13.9 trillion to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. To get to a total of $10 trillion investment over this period, the government needs to spend roughly $370 billion a year on clean energy. In his Build Back Better bill, Biden proposed $555 billion to combat climate change over the rest of the decade. But Senator Joe Manchin objected to the money for clean energy, forcing Biden to cut the monies for mitigating the worst effects of the climate change. With an estimated personal investment of $1 to $5 million in his coal brokerage business and hundreds of thousands of dollars donated to his office by energy corporations, Senator Manchin refuses to support any appropriations for clean energy. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains the second largest producer of greenhouse gas in the world. If left unchecked, the cost to the nation of greenhouse gases may total $14.5 trillion by 2070, according to Deloitte, an organization that tracks the global carbon footprint. In late January 2022, the Biden administration's sale of Gulf of Mexico gas and oil leases were roundly rejected in court. Federal Judge Rodolph Contreras ruled that the Biden administration had acted arbitrarily and capriciously in the sale of leases for 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. He canceled the sales, ruling that the administration had not sufficiently considered the sales' effect on climate change. Environmental groups also fault the Interior Department for using an outdated analysis that found that no greenhouse gases would be emitted from the production of oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico. They call for a new analysis that examines the broader impact of burning these fossil fuels on climate change. They point out that 25% of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions are from burning fossil fuels produced on public lands and in federal waters. Judge Contreras also ruled that the auction of lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico violated the 1970 National Environmental Policy Act. It stipulates that the government must consider the environmental impact of drilling and construction projects before it auctions off leases. According to the Washington Post, the Biden administration nevertheless plans to auction off 200,000 acres to the fossil fuel industry in western states by the end of March. An additional 1 million acres of lease sales in the Cook Inlet in Alaska will also be auctioned off after the March sale. These sales egregiously contradict Biden's campaign promise of no more drilling on federal lands, period, period, period. The fossil fuel industry, for its part, argues that the added production in the Gulf of Mexico will keep down gas and oil prices and contribute to the nation's energy security. This argument is politically palatable to an administration now wary of inflation criticism from Republicans and upcoming interim elections. At the same time, though, the fossil fuel industry's assessment ignores the signs of climate change. If greenhouse gases are not dramatically curbed, climate change models predict that average global temperature will rise 4 degrees Celsius, that is 4.2 degrees Fahrenheit, over the rest of the country, while scientists generally agree that an increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, must be the goal to avoid the most catastrophic climate events. The U.S. and global community of nations must adopt clean energy standards as soon as possible. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Energy, IPCC, in its 2021 report, illustrates how imperative immediate action is. In this report, the sixth assessment it has issued since 1988, it highlights five essential observations based on scientific review of the growing body of literature on climate change. Climate change is indisputably human-caused. 2010 to 2020 was the hottest decade in 125,000 years. Certain changes we've already seen are irreversible. Greenhouse gas emissions are the leading cause of the climate change, and climate events are increasing in severity and number in any region of the planet. Frequent natural disasters in the U.S. have been on an upward trend since 1980, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In the first decade of record-breaking, the total of cost of natural disaster was about $700 billion, or $70 billion in annual average. In most recent decade, however, the cost have escalated to roughly $2.9 billion. These calculations make it quite clear that natural disasters in the United States may seem equal Biden's proposed clean energy expenditures of $555 billion.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The French presidential election in 2022 is here, and the results so far show a downturn in the participation rate, around 65%, down sharply from the same point back in the year 2017 when elections took place. The obvious question, why do French voters feel that they should not come out and vote like before, especially during uncertain economic times? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Emmanuel Macron, the current president's five-year report card, and why the contender Marine Le Pen actually has gained in popularity. And we will also take a look at the Muslim vote and why Macron may have lost that demographic. First, let's get an idea about some of the results that have come out from our correspondent Rami Mazari, who joins us from Paris to tell us about that.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate Valérie Pécresse was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Rami Mazari, Paris.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist, joins us from Normandy. Also joining us, Arnold August, an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Jeff Brown, let me first start with you. So we're looking at a turnout that's 4 percentage points lower than at the same stage that occurred back in 2017. At the same time, based on the initial results, Macron seen at 29.5%, Le Pen 23.5%. Your initial reaction to that?
Well, this is exactly what happened in 2017, and my wife and I voted in that election, and we voted in the election today. And the problem is that the press is totally controlled by the elites. And what's going to happen now in round two is that they will totally demonize Le Pen and call her a fascist, radical, racist, extremist, to push the people towards Macron. And in 2017, and before the first round, they made her look like she was an angel and a princess and a wonderful lady. And no, she's not that bad. And she's not that radical, because they did not want Mélenchon to get into the final round, because I think he's the only candidate that might have any chance of beating Macron. So here we are again, the left with seven parties, all splintered. If all of those parties had backed Mélenchon, Mélenchon would be going against Macron in the second round.
I think
he could beat him.
Why do you think they didn't? At this point, do we have any who have endorsed either?
Well, the left in France has always been highly splintered. You've got communists and Workers' Party, and then the socialists, ecologists. Two or three different communist parties, and there's a lot of infighting, a lot of jealousy, a lot of the left here has been talking forever about a unified left, and the last time that happened, Mitterrand got elected, and that has not happened since.
Okay, Arnold August, looking over here, moving to the second round with obviously Macron and Le Pen, if you haven't heard. Let's break this down a little bit and first talk about whichever you like. Let's pick Le Pen. What do you think of Le Pen? She's being described, as our guest there said back in 2017, of being an extremist and so forth and so on, but now she has portrayed and been successful in portraying herself as somewhat more moderate. And that obviously was to allay any concerns that the voters may have. Do you agree with that? What are your views on Le Pen?
Well, of course, yeah, she is definitely, and this is always the case in these type of elections, such as in France or United States or Canada, people on the right try to shift change their appearance to be, more moderate in order to try to get some more votes. But one thing is very interesting, talking about trying to be more moderate, is that she actually visited Moscow, I think, in 2017, and she came back saying that she had a high regard for President Putin. Of course, now Macron is fighting against that, saying, showing pictures of her in Moscow and trying to denigrate her with regards to the international affairs of being soft on Russia. So, it's a shift. It's a mixed ground. I mean, there's no clear way that one could describe Le Pen at this time, because everything is shifting according to circumstances, with the one and only goal trying to get votes.
When we take a look at the way that you said, Jeff Brown, that the media controls the way that these contenders and the incumbent is portrayed, perhaps showing the pluses and minuses, what is the real story, do you think? For example, we had our correspondent when he spoke to us, saying that 7 out of 10 voters actually support Macron, but we're not seeing that at the polls. Or support Le Pen. Is that how, what is the deal? I mean, who has more popularity here?
Before every election, everyone who's registered to vote here receives a packet of information with the platform for all, and there were 12 candidates, mind you, which is too many. That's part of the problem with the French electoral system. And when you read Le Pen's platform, I don't think she's radical at all. She is definitely much more liberal than any Republican.
Give us one point that stands out.
Well, one point, she has a very socialist-minded, in terms of the 99% medical care, taking care of the people, providing, public services, et cetera. In fact, her economic advisor came from the Socialist Party. The only thing that she gets demonized here for is because she's the daughter of Mr. Le Pen, who was overtly racist. Le Pen is just against immigration, but that is not an unpopular platform around the world. And so, I mean, to be honest with you, other than the fact that she's against immigration, she's as far as I'm concerned, she's as much on the left as some of the other left-wing candidates. So the problem is the press is going to absolutely push her, or they're going to destroy her in the next 2 weeks, because we have to wait 2 weeks for the second round on the 24th. They will destroy her, The other thing is Macron, he's not middle of the road. He's a neoliberal right winger. He's a very neoliberal. World Economic Forum, Council on Foreign Relations. He is more right wing than Le Pen. But the press will make sure that that's not how it's portrayed, and that's the big problem here. The mass media, what I call the big lie propaganda machine, is what it decides who gets elected, unfortunately.
So let's put that into perspective, if we can, or if you can, Arnold August. We know that Marie Le Pen, one of the platforms that she ran on is the fact that she wants to somehow focus on the cost of living crisis and be able to tame that. Of course, we know that that's a huge problem for the French. Now, Macron, on the other hand, I'm not too sure how well he has done. They're touting a 7% GDP growth, but then when you take a look at the real figures, you can see that the deficit is still high. You're having a manufacturer base in France that's gone out of business. They're not doing that well. And also, we're looking at one of the worst inflations when it comes to energy. So who stands better? Who can fare better under those circumstances, you think?
Well, I think that, describing these specific programs of these two candidates, I don't think that it has very much currency or very much legitimacy amongst the population. Here in Montreal, there's a large number of French citizens, of course, who are voting today. And speaking briefly with them over the last few days, their frustration is, how come? I mean, the previous speaker talked about the role of the media. It's very important. And I think the most important feature of the media in these elections is they focus solely on Le Pen and Macron, as if these are the only two candidates that count, that have a chance of winning. So it's like a vicious circle. They avoid talking about Mélenchon, and they concentrate on the other two, making it like a sure bet that there's no chance for Mélenchon can win, and one only the other two can win. Now, as far as I know, Mélenchon has a 11% rating amongst the voters. In other words, it's quite important. And I, speaking to my friends here in Montreal who are voting, they're very disappointed that this time the Communist Party of France did not sit it out as they did previously and openly support Mélenchon. And if they would have done that, I think we would be in a different situation now, far more solid, with chances very much improved for Mélenchon to actually get into that second round. And I think that if one look at his general program internationally and nationally, it is very good. It's a solid left-wing program. There's no real reason why the Communist Party of France did not drop their own, you know, sectarian, if I may use the word, interests and goals, and in support, put all their backing in support of Mélenchon. He's a very dynamic person. And the fact that the media are just ignoring him, we may be in for some kind of a surprise, because the voter turnout is so low. It is mainly because people have no confidence in the two main candidates and their programs, which more often than not seem to be just, well, platitudes to try to get votes. Is very obvious. And we could actually have a surprise this Sunday with regards to Mélenchon. Let us see.
Well, we need to talk about the economy a little bit more here, Jeff Brown. And I'm looking at comments made back in 2017, because I had a record of that. And one of them said, "You can't make it to the end of the month." This is just one of the French protesters, which we'll talk about where he was protesting. You can't make it to the end of the month, even with two salaries. Looking at some of the comments now made by some of the French, they're still struggling to make ends meet. So what has Macron done? And we're looking again at the voter focus, which is during this post, if I can call it that, post-COVID era, whether the French government under Macron can handle what's coming its way, as opposed to Le Pen.
Well, since 2017, Macron, you have to understand that Macron is a neoliberal Trojan horse. He is a Rothschild regent. He was cultivated by the Rothschild family, Goldman Sachs. He is an elitist and has absolutely no concern whatsoever for the common man. In fact, he's going to give his speech tonight at Versailles, you know, where Louis the 14th was, you know. But the problem is that, I mean, everything has gone south since the European Treaty in 2007. Salaries are going nowhere. Inflation's going up. Social services for the 99% are being slashed. Since Macron got elected in 2017, just as just one example, 17,000 hospital beds have been shut down. Taxes have been raised on the 99%. Taxes have been lowered on the 1%. Austerity has been increased on the 99%. Austerity doesn't exist for the 1%. That's why the yellow vests have been out there for the last 3 years, and Rahman Mazahiri has done a brilliant job. They express the frustration, and we live here. A year ago, we bought 1,000 liters of heating oil for 777 euros. We just paid 1,966 euros for that same 1,000 liters of heating oil. So it's a disaster. I mean, he is a disaster, but he is a disaster for the 99%. He is a dream come true for Washington, the Council on Foreign Relations, the World Economic Forum, the CIA. He is their man. And right. But you turn on the French television, and you don't see this. You don't hear it. The yellow vests are invisible. That guy you quoted never sees the light of day except on press TV and other alternative websites. So it is just propaganda, 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 and the big lie propaganda machine makes sure that the 1% candidate gets in, and that's happened with Sarkozy and Hollande, and now with Macron, and he will get in for the second in the second round.
Well, Arnold August, how can that be turned around? A and B, do you think the French will be able to see through that based on what our guest there from Normandy said, because obviously inflation, whether it's energy, food prices, basic goods, is going through the roof in many cases.
Well, I have to be an optimistic guy this morning. And, you know, France has its revolutionary traditions going back several centuries. And they have stood up to a lot of the neoliberal policies that have been going on in France over the last few years. I have hope that Mélenchon will, after all, be able to get into the second round. That's what I'm hoping for. And the people I'm speaking here in Montreal are hoping for that as well. But the basic thing, the headlines are the voter turnout is down. One. Why? They don't say so. But the voter turnout is down because all the emphasis are on those two, you know, one, as the previous speaker said, the two 1% candidates who are not like the vast majority. So will their political consciousness be, you know, sharp enough, rebellious enough to make a break from the status quo, focus only on those two 1% candidates and make a move to try to get Mélenchon into the second round, which I still think possible.
I'm going to now end it with a quote. I'm stuck between Le Pen and Macron. I'm going to go with Le Pen. If I can ask you, Jeff Brown, this is what she has said in her campaign trail. The presidential election day is a very important day because considering the situation of the country and the world, it will determine the course of not only the next 5 years, but also possibly the next 50 years. Do you agree with her?
It may be a little bit hyperbolic, but yeah, this is an important time for France and an important election. She lost 34% to 66% in 2017, and my wife and I voted for her in the second round because we knew that Macron was a train wreck to kill the working people in the 99%. I think Macron is still going to win, but the margin will be less. But he will, unfortunately, sadly, is still going to win.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you, Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist from Normandy. Arnold August, a pleasure, author and journalist there from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
UK's Labour leader, Keir Starmer, questions the ability of super-rich politicians to relate to public amid cost-of-living crisis. Here we present you an article in this regard, written jointly by Jessica Ilgard, Rowena Mason, and Rupert Neat, under the heading Starmer says Sonak completely out of touch on everyday struggles. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. UK's Labour leader Keir Starmer has accused Chancellor of Exchequer Rishi Sunak of rank hypocrisy and questioned the ability of super-rich politicians to relate to the public as Number 10 came under pressure to reveal if any other ministers had used the schemes to avoid tax. In an interview with The Guardian amid controversy over Rishi Sunak's wife tax status, Starmer said having a spouse who was a non-dom would create a very obvious conflict of interest for any cabinet minister. He called on the Prime Minister to make clear that no other cabinet ministers has taken advantage of non-dom status, used tax havens, or benefited from offshore trust. Sunak has referred himself to the advisor on ministerial interests for an inquiry, and his wife, Akshata Murthy, recently said she would pay all UK tax on foreign earnings in future. Sajid Javid, the health secretary, also admitted on Sunday, April 10th, to having been a non-dom for 6 years while a banker before he was an MP. But despite the continuing public outcry, Number 10 on Monday, April 11th, said it could not reveal whether any other ministers or their spouses held or had previously held non-dom tax status. Starmer said the Chancellor still had basic things to answer about how much tax his family had avoided, with Murthy's non-dom status, with estimates she legally avoided paying UK taxes of £20 million on overseas earnings. Sunak's own financial interests are also under scrutiny as he resisted calls to reveal what assets he has put into blind management arrangement, meaning they can be kept secret from the public. The Lib Dems on Monday, April 11th, wrote to Catherine Stone, the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, asking her to launch an inquiry into why Sunak had declared no financial interest between 2015 and 2019 as an MP, but then revealed the existence of a blind trust in 2019 when he became a Treasury Minister. Sunak has never revealed his wife's international interest on his list of ministerial interests, although he does declare her holding in the UK-based Katraman Ventures. She's known to hold about £690 million in shares in Infoice, the Indian IT company founded by her billionaire father. The Guardian has also established that Murthy has held U.S. investments through a trust in her own name, Akshata Narayana Murthy Trust, which is revealed in American filings. Her spokesperson had no comment. Apart from that, all rules were followed. There are also continuing questions around Sunak's possession of a U.S. green card for permanent residence, including for 6 years as an MP and government minister. Sunak left his job in the U.S. in 2013, but declared the same year in a U.K. company filing that he was resident in the U.K., suggesting he was giving different information to the British and U.S. authorities about his residency. The U.S. states that green card holders should give up their status if they take up residence elsewhere. Despite warnings that Sunak may have flouted U.S. immigration rules, the Chancellor is understood to be heading to Washington in coming days for International Monetary Fund spring meetings. The row over the tax arrangements of Murthy, who has said she has maintained her non-dom status in part because she hopes to return to her birth country of India, has reportedly led Sunak to question his future in UK politics. asked if there were issues with politicians from a super wealthy elite becoming prime minister, Starmer said it would be likely to pose problems. He said, "There is much more likely to be a conflict of interest. I don't know many people who have signed up to a non-dom scheme in order to increase their tax. It is pretty obvious why people do it." But he also said there was a broader issue about politicians' disconnection from ordinary people's lives. Starmer noted, "I think that even before we got to the non-dom issue, the chancellor's response to the spring statement to the real pressures on the people showed that he just doesn't get it." Starmer highlighted Sunak's own personal wealth, his four homes, and his reference to having four different types of bread in his house, as well as his decision to borrow a Sainsbury's worker's ordinary car for a photo shoot. As evidence, he was completely out of touch. The Labour leader said, you know, whether that's picking up somebody else's car, whether it's four loaves of bread in his own family, whether it's a number of houses, it's about where he gets it. It's about whether you understand, whether you can relate to the very real struggles that people have and the cost of living crisis. And it dominates every discussion we have around the country. Starmer has so far refused to commit to Labour's long-standing policy to abolish non-dom status, first announced by Ed Miliband in 2015, but said the party was undertaking an extensive review of the tax system. Speaking to The Guardian on a campaign visit to Sunderland, Keir Starmer hinted that he was uncomfortable with the system of overseas tax status, adding, "Most people don't get that choice. It's only a very small minority of people. This has been portrayed as some complex tax situation. It's not." Starmer also expressed some hesitation at the idea politicians should publish their own tax returns, saying it was overcomplicated and that all proper declarations should be made. But he added, "There is nothing to reveal in my tax returns, but I can tell you, if I was prime minister, I wouldn't be going to the country saying I want more tax from you. But secretly, I'm reducing my own tax burden through schemes. It's rank hypocrisy." Starmer said that he had been hearing deeply worrying stories from voters on the campaign trail about the way that rising energy bills and inflation were affecting their lives. He said, "They're really worried about paying the bills. The most repeated thing said to me, particularly from older people, is that they are not putting the heating on or sitting in their dressing gown all day because they are too scared to turn up the heating." Adding, "Somebody said to me, I don't put our central heating up higher than 12 degrees. Someone recently said to me in the supermarket, now I pick things up and then put them back down again and try to get something cheaper." He said Labour had a message about practical ways to deal with the problems and said people were receptive to his party's message on taxing the extra profits of oil and gas companies to reduce energy bills. He claimed, "Of course, we've got to show that we are the party to be trusted with the economy, but I think we are doing that."